Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If you work full-time at minimum wage, you're probably living near or below the poverty line. That's why earlier this month, Oregon and Maryland joined 19 other states, 21 cities, and raised the minimum wage. But some states are going the other way, like Missouri, which just approved a law to roll back a minimum wage hike in St. Louis from $10 an hour down to the state minimum of $7.70. Proponents say it will save jobs. Opponents say it will hurt low-wage workers. This hour on Point, the minimum wage debate. You can join us on air or online. Are you making ends meet on a minimum wage? Do you favor the raising of the minimum wage? Do you oppose it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now is Ben Castleman. He's senior editor and the chief economics writer for 538. He's been looking at the national picture and how minimum wage changes are affecting cities and states across the country. You can find an excerpt of his piece, Seattle's Minimum Wage Hike May Have Gone Too Far, at our website, onpointradio.org. Ben Castleman, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me on.
Can we talk a little bit about what happened in Missouri? So if I understand it correctly, the city of St. Louis had a $10 minimum wage. The state came in and passed a law, essentially passing a law that would roll back that minimum wage back to the state minimum of $7.70. Give us a little background into what we know about that.
Yeah, I mean, so we've seen this, of course, across the country, we've seen this minimum wage movement, and it's really been driven at the city level. We've started to see some states now, but really it's been at the city level, at San Francisco, Oakland, Seattle, New York City, places that have raised their minimum wages. St. Louis went with that wave and pushed the minimum wage there up to $10 an hour. That's a little lower than some of the places that we've seen. At the same time, we've started to see this backlash of some states, generally Republican-run states, that have been sort of pushing back against that movement. And we've seen a number of states that have passed these so-called preemption laws to stop local cities, usually democratically-run cities, from raising their minimum wages. What really sets the situation in Missouri apart is that St. Louis has already gone ahead and raised its minimum wage. So we're not just talking about stopping a city from raising their minimum wage. We're actually talking about rolling it back. So the minimum wage right now in St. Louis is $10. Under this new law, come August, we'll see it go back to the state-level minimum wage of $7.70. This was all caught up in some court battles, and so it took sort of a while for this all to play out. But barring any further developments, that's what we'll see, is low-wage workers will conceivably, at least legally, will be allowed to take a substantial pay cut in St. Louis. Mm.
So, Ben, give us sort of run through the arguments for and against these so-called preemption laws. First, what's the case in favor of laws like this?
Well, I mean, the case in favor of sort of a lower minimum wage, the conservative case has sort of long been that if you raise the minimum wage too far, it's going to hurt the workers that these laws are designed to help, that it will lead to lost jobs and lost hours, that if you're a fast food restaurant or if you're a retailer and you employ low-wage workers, that if the wages go up, it's a tight margin business, you're going to cut back their hours, you're going to cut workers' jobs. And so states are saying, you know, we need to, again, Republican-run states are saying we sort of need to prevent cities from hurting their own economies. And we can obviously talk about the evidence for and against that. You know, there is sort of an economic principle here that in general kind of having bright line boundaries is tricky, right? If mm-hmm. St. Louis is an interesting example here because it's a relatively small city surrounded by a county, a minimum wage that goes up there, it's relatively easy for a business, especially a business that can trade, sell goods across the state. It's pretty easy for them to pick up and leave the city of St. Louis and go to the surrounding county. And so there is an argument to be made that having a consistent minimum wage, either statewide or nationwide, or at least sort of within a metro area to make it more difficult for businesses just to sort of pick up and choose their location, that there's some argument in favor of that.
Now, it's just interesting to sort of put this in perspective and really look at the numbers. So at $7.70 an hour, let's assume that someone is earning that full time. We ran the numbers, and that would work out to about $308 a week, $1,200 a month, about just shy of $14,000 a year. That puts you just a little bit above the poverty line as an individual. That puts you substantially below the poverty line if you're a family of two, way below if you're a family of four. So would that be the argument in favor of keeping this minimum wage where it is, and raising the minimum wage elsewhere in the country? I mean, is that what it's about, trying to get people up above the poverty line?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that are sort of pushing against each other here. So on the one hand, absolutely, I think there's a principle that almost anybody would sort of side with, which is this idea that if you work full time, you ought to be able to, you know, at least live above the poverty line. You ought to be able to afford to live and ideally start to raise a family if you're working full time. And it is certainly the case that the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, and many local minimum wages, that is not the case. It's also the case, I think, we sometimes think about the minimum wage workers as being teenagers or being people who are working second jobs or supplementary incomes, and that has become less true over time. There are still lots of teenagers who work minimum wage, but there are a lot of people in their 20s and their 30s, and I've spoken to people in their 40s and their 50s who earn minimum wages. And I've done research that has found that people are getting stuck in those jobs for longer. And so that it used to be you'd sort of enter in a minimum wage job and you'd quickly move up. And that's become less true over time, that people are kind of getting stuck in, if not minimum, then at least sort of low-wage jobs. The counter to this, of course, is that just because we want to be able to say we're going to require you to pay a wage that allows somebody to live doesn't necessarily mean that that's what businesses will do, that businesses could cut back hours, that they could lay people off. And so if you're a worker who keeps your job and you keep your hours, then of course a $10, a $12, a $15 minimum wage is much better than a $7, $8, $9 minimum wage. But if you lose your job, then you're worse off. And so I think there is a question here about if the goal here is to help low-wage workers, then which policies best do that? The minimum wage is one set of policies that's designed to help low-wage workers, but it's not the only one.
Right. Okay. Joining us now is Ed Brock, the third-generation owner of Johnny Dungeon Party Warehouse, one of the largest costume stores in downtown St. Louis. He hires lots of seasonal employees, and he's actually in favor of the recent law that essentially brings the minimum wage down to the state minimum of $7.70. And Ed, welcome to On Point. It's good of you to join us.
Hi, Anthony.
So you favor what the state legislature did. Tell us why.
Well, when the minimum wage jumped from $7.70 up to $10, first of all, myself, as well as many other local business owners, talked amongst each other, and it was such a blow to our operating costs that, you know, it had increased, I think the percentage is close to 30%, to jump from $7.70 to $10 is quite a large pill to swallow. And, you know, in the amount of time that since, I think, May, I'm not sure exactly the date of which it occurred, but I had calculated that I had spent an additional $2,200 from the point at which it increased up until currently, and that may not sound like a lot of money, but for a small business owner, you know, the money has to come from somewhere.
No, I understand that. So, Ed Brock, I want to just ask you this. I mean, did the raise of the minimum wage in St. Louis affect your company in a way that compelled you to lay people off, or did you have to resist hiring more people, which you might have done had the minimum wage been lower?
Well, I did not lay anybody off, so there were no effects that in that regards. But we did increase a few employees. Most of my employees, matter of fact, at the time, all of my employees were over the minimum wage. So a few of the employees needed to be increased from, say, $8.50 or $9 an hour to $10, which in and of itself was not a big blow to my business. But when it comes to, you know, a lot of times these laws are passed, and, you know, we all make generalizations of how businesses can, you know, handle things like taxes or increased taxes or minimum wage, but there's so many factors. In my business, because it's very seasonal, I hire a lot of temporary employees come September and October and employ them all the way through the fourth quarter to the end of the year. Well, if I'm hiring temporary employees in at $10 an hour, it's not only that additional cost, but then I have to raise everybody else that works for me that's been working at 10 or 11 or 12 or 13. They say, well, why shouldn't we get more? You've got somebody just coming in that's not as qualified as we are, and they're making close to what we make. So in essence, it raises everybody up 30%. Well, trying to run a business and increasing your wages by 30%, your salaries by 30%, is just almost an impossible task. So what do we do? Ultimately, I would have to lay off staff. I would have to just go with less staff. I'd ultimately would probably raise prices of my product because...
So less staff, higher costs. Ed Brock, we got it. And we understand as a small business owner why you support what happened out there in Missouri to roll back the minimum wage. Ed Brock is the third generation owner of Johnny Dungeon Party Warehouse in St. Louis. Ed, thanks for joining us and good luck to you. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Anthony.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing changes to the minimum wage across the nation, including moves by some states to lower the minimum wage. We heard from the state of Missouri and St. Louis, where they rolled back the minimum wage just a moment ago. You can join the conversation. Are you struggling to get by on minimum wage, hoping for a raise? Are you an employer forced to lay off workers because the minimum wage is too high? How do we strike the right balance? Back in February, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa spoke at a town hall in Parkersburg where he discussed the times he had voted against raising the national minimum wage.
If we have high unemployment, then I don't want to increase the cost of labor because you increase the cost of something, you get less of it. And the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said that 750,000, mostly young people, would be unemployed the last time the issue was up in the Congress of the United States.
So there's that side of the argument. Last April, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, in an interview with CBS, argued for the reasons why a higher minimum wage would benefit working families in America.
Higher minimum wage saved my family. A low minimum wage today is dragging families who work sometimes three jobs and still can't support a family. That's not right. And it's not on the heads of the families who work. It's on the heads of politicians in Washington who decide that corporate interests are vastly more important.
Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts speaking on CBS last April. I'm joined by Ben Castleman, senior editor and the chief economics writer for 538. Ben, so there's sort of the range of arguments from Senator Grassley and Senator Warren. I wanted to get your response, though. Before the break, we heard from Ed Brock, owner of a small company in St. Louis, speaking for the pressures that a small business owner feels. What did you hear in his concerns there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth highlighting one point in particular that he made, which is he talked about the speed of the increase from $7.70 in St. Louis to $10, kind of overnight, and we're seeing that now in a number of places. Some of the places where they're raising the minimum wage is typically, over the course of a couple of years, but sometimes really pretty quickly, where we're going from 8 to 9 to 10 to 11, sometimes jumping up by two or more dollars at a go. And that's tough for a business to respond to. And I think it's sort of worth noting we're running a little bit of an experiment in this country right now, where there are cities across the country that are raising their minimum wage both very quickly and to levels that we really have very little experience with in this country. When we start talking about minimum wages of $12 and $13 and $15, that's really, even accounting for inflation, pretty unprecedented in this country. And economists really don't have a strong sense of what impact that will have. We have much more research on minimum wages of $7 and $8 and kind of the equivalent. But as we start to see these rapid increases and increases to higher levels, that does put a strain on businesses, and I think we're sort of trying to figure out what the impact of that will be.
Well, we're going to be talking about Seattle's minimum wage hike going forward, and I just want to ask you, if you could sort of give us the top three or four lines of your piece. Seattle's minimum wage hike may have gone too far. You can link to that, by the way, at onpointradio.org. So Seattle is one of those cities that went pretty high, up to $15, right?
Yeah, they're kind of at the leading edge of this movement. They went from about $9.50 up to $11, and then less than a year later up to $13, and then in January up to $15 for some employers, for larger employers. And that's really sort of testing limits that we don't have much experience with. To Seattle's credit, they've commissioned some studies that have been done looking at what the effect is. And there's some research that's come out of the University of Washington now that has suggested that when it went up to $11, it was kind of a wash. It benefited some workers, it hurt some others as they lost hours. It kind of didn't have much of an impact, plus or minus. But when it went up to $13, this was at the start of 2016, that low wage workers lost jobs, or more particularly, they got their hours cut back, and that actually the net impact on low wage workers was negative. Now I know we're going to hear from some other people here, and so we can unpack this a little bit more. There's been research that has found the opposite. There's been sort of a lot of complexity to this. If you take that study at face value, and we'll talk about the reasons why you might not, then that would suggest that sort of Seattle has hit some sort of threshold where once it got to $13 an hour, that was sort of too high for the economy to sustain without hurting some workers. And Seattle is a very high cost of living place, right? Much more so than St. Louis that we were just talking about. So if it's the case that $13 or $15 is sort of too high in Seattle, that would really start to call into question sort of how well the economies of other cities and states could maintain that kind of wage.
All right. Well, as you said, we're going to sort of dig into that report about the Seattle minimum wage. But first, I want to get some callers into this conversation. We've got a lot of them. Let's go to Joseph, who's calling from Clearwater, Florida. Joseph, good to have you on the air.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there.
Yes, I'm originally from St. Louis. I lived in the suburbs in Fenton, where we used to have the second largest United Auto Workers plant, Chrysler plant, in North America. I've seen what the Republican Party has done to the whole country, if not the city of St. Louis. St. Louis used to be a good union-based community, and now this governor, first thing he does is make us the 38th state right to work. People can't live on hardly $10 an hour, even in St. Louis, even though they don't have a higher rate of living than Seattle. This country needs a total $15 hour minimum wage for the whole country, and therefore the businesses can set forth their protocol as to how they run their businesses. I'm tired of these Republicans complaining about it's going to hurt jobs. All it's doing is hurting the bottom line for the very rich.
All right, Joseph, we hear you loud and clear, and we're going to certainly take on your point of view in the time that remains this hour. Let's go to Ken, who's calling from Douglas, Georgia. Ken, you're on the air.
Thanks, Anthony. I just wanted to mention that I'm a teacher here in Georgia. And at $15 an hour, that's almost entry level for a teacher who has a bachelor's degree. So I'm somewhat against the minimum wage increase, what I think we should do is have an entry level like we have. But then you then make it mandatory that every year you get like a dollar year raise. I mean, you've been to some places where people work minimum wage and the service is absolutely horrible. And then you see some people that come in, there's new people. But then you'll have the occasional place that you go to and someone's been there for years and they're such a hard worker and the employer doesn't have to hire as many people when you have people that really work hard. And to me, those people should get a raise. And then it gives them a reason to stay and get some stability within a company, and the company will, you know, show some investment in that employee. I just think that they should earn that right. If you say, okay, everybody gets $15 an hour, then there's no reason to go any farther, because why am I going to bust my tail if...
Ken, we hear it. Yeah, we get it. It's an interesting point. Thanks for putting that on the table. You know, Ben Castleman, listening to the last two calls, I mean, one of the things that I'm struck by, and I wanted to, especially by what Ken was just talking about in the state of Georgia, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about this, the range of minimum wages across the country. I'm looking at some numbers here from the U.S. Department of Labor, where Ken was calling from in the state of Georgia, the minimum wage, $5.15. District of Columbia, $12.50. The state of Washington, $11. And of course, we talked about Seattle passing a law at $15. So it might be hard to talk about a sort of national minimum wage raise when there's such a range already out there.
Yeah, I should note, of course, that the federal minimum wage is $7.25, and so anywhere that's covered by the federal minimum wage, even if the state minimum wage is lower, will still be covered by the federal.
So that's what one of the questions I wanted to ask you. So yeah. If Georgia's minimum wage is $5.50, that's preempted by the federal minimum wage?
With a few exceptions of a few types of businesses that for various reasons aren't covered by federal. But in general, that's right.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's absolutely true. There's a huge range in minimum wages nationally. There's also a huge range in cost of living nationally and in median wages nationally. You know, there's a I was looking this up earlier in preparation for this, that Seattle's median hourly wage is close to $24 an hour. St. Louis is about $18 an hour, right? So the impact of a $15 minimum wage is very different in a place with a $24 where most workers earn $24 or more versus a place where people earn $18. And you know, I don't have the Georgia numbers in front of me here, but I suspect that where Ken is calling from, the median wage is substantially lower than that. And so there is some logic to sort of saying, you know, you set a federal minimum wage that makes sense nationally, but then you let local areas go up above that in you know, relation to their local cost of living.
Right. Let me get a couple more voices into this conversation. Joining us now via Skype from Chestertown, Maryland, is Salim Firth. He's a research fellow in macroeconomics at the Heritage Foundation. And he points to a recent University of Washington study, which we mentioned earlier in the hour, that found that Seattle's $15 minimum wage hike last year led to less pay and to some job losses. Salim Firth, thanks for joining us. We're very grateful.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you.
And also joining us from Berkeley, California, is Michael Reich. He's professor of economics and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's authored numerous minimum wage studies, including one that also examined Seattle's minimum wage hike, which concluded that the hike raises pay without costing jobs. So we're going to try to get into this a little bit. Michael Reich, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And let me start with you, Michael, about your study on Seattle's minimum wage hike. What did you find?
Well, we found that the Seattle minimum wage is working quite well, and that corresponds to all the reports on the ground, where we have not heard so many complaints as would be implied by the UW study you mentioned. We find growth in jobs and growth in wages in the among the workers who would be affected, that is, those who are being paid before less than $13 an hour. Our focus is on the restaurant industry, a traditional focus for academics because it is the biggest user of low-wage workers. And this is a part of a series of studies that I'm doing, not just on Seattle, but on other cities, where, including lower wage or lower cost of living cities, where we're finding similar effects.
Hmm. Respond to, you know, early in the hour, we heard from a small business owner in St. Louis who was talking about his support of rolling the minimum wage back. And you know, I'd love you to respond to just that sort of intuitive sense that comes from a small business owner that, you know, if you raise rate wages past a certain point, inevitably it is going to have an effect on a business that's going to cause them to either lay people off, raise prices, or do a number of things that might not be good for folks out there.
Well, it is intuitive that at some point minimum wages would have harmful effects, but we don't know what that point is. We don't know that it occurs at $15. And so far, I'm not finding it at 15. I'm sure it would occur at $150.
Right.
That's not on the table. That business owner, first of all, is going to find it easier to recruit and retain his workers, particularly the temp workers. He's going to save money. The workers are going to be harder working. We know that from the research. And we also know that his actual increases in labor costs will be a lot less than the 30%, because quite a few of his workers might get a raise of just a dollar or two, as he mentioned. And he probably has some workers who are even higher wage who won't get a increase at all. So when you factor in the actual wage increases he'll be giving, plus the fact that labor is only about 20 probably or 30% of costs for him, then he could raise prices and absorb the entire cost of the minimum wage. The price increase would probably be just a couple of cents on the dollar. And this is the kind of thing that an individual business owner doesn't see, because they don't realize that the effects are going to be the same on all businesses. So all the other stores in his, you know, in his industry will raise prices a couple of cents or on the dollar, and you know, that's the industry that the people who buy costumes or whatever they're buying aren't going to really stop buying them for that reason. They're also not likely to go outside of St. Louis to buy such things, because it's not worth it. There's traffic costs, time costs, and so on. I found that to be the case when San Jose raised its minimum wage overnight from $8 to $10.
Okay, Michael Reich, before we switch cities, I want to go to Salim Firth, because I know he's got a different view on what happened in Seattle. So, Salim, respond to Michael Reich and tell me what you see in that University of Washington study on Seattle's $15 minimum wage hike last year.
Sure. To me, the most interesting thing about the Seattle study was that we had the study that Michael did that came out a week before the study that the University of Washington economists did. And they actually replicated his findings. So they were able to show that using their data, which is they have sort of special access to state data that nobody else has. We're all very jealous. They found that, yes, indeed, there were no net job losses in the restaurant sector. But they could, unlike the rest of us, identify specific workers, who's actually making what wage. And they found that there were large job losses for those who were in the lower wage category. So they ended up with sort of showing, yes, the restaurant sector looks the way that Michael and others have previously found it to be, but there are losses. And it might be that restaurants are really hard to move, that you don't drive out of Seattle to get dinner, but you do, say, if you're looking at a home care company, you choose one that's based in the suburbs rather than one that's based in the city. Or you choose not to create a new establishment in Seattle that employs those kind of workers. We don't know the technical dynamics, but what's interesting is that this study found no contradiction between the idea the restaurant sector could, you know, remain smooth, replace some low-wage workers with some high-wage workers, and, you know, keep things on an even keel, but there's still large job losses overall.
Ben Castleman, help us out here, because, you know, I'm in the role of sort of the average listener here, and I hear two smart guys who are talking about important work that they're doing and analyzing and coming to two completely different conclusions.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that highlights sort of the state of where we are right now. There have been decades of minimum wage research, but as we were talking about earlier, that's tended to focus on lower minimum wages and slower increases. That research, there's plenty of dispute about the details, but I think in broad terms, it has tended to find that those kinds of modest increases have pretty modest impacts on unemployment. But now we're in a new world, and so it's going to take some time, I think, for us to fully explore what happens with these minimum wages at this higher level, and that's kind of the way the science is meant to work.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the minimum wage debate. You can join the conversation. So workers protested in the lobby of a Hardee's fast food restaurant in Birmingham, Alabama last month to protest the low minimum wage there. They demanded a $15 minimum wage.
What do we want?
15!
What do we want?
Now!
If we don't get it,
shut down!
If we don't get it,
shut down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
Hardee's workers there in Birmingham, Alabama last month protesting for a $15 minimum wage. With me is Ben Castleman, senior editor and chief economics writer for 538, Salim Firth, research fellow in macroeconomics at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Reich, professor of economics and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California at Berkeley. And Salim and Michael, let me come back to both of you because I didn't mean to be too flippant before the break, but I did want to make the point that sometimes when we hear research, the average listener is left sort of scratching their head saying, you know, how do we make sense of this? And it seems like it comes down to political point of view, perhaps. So here's my question. Do you two agree on what the purpose of the minimum wage is? Or let me just put the question. I'll start with you, Michael Reich. What's the purpose of the minimum wage?
Yeah, the purpose of the minimum wage is to set a standard of living that's a livable wage. That's what was enshrined in the law in 1938 and was expressed very clearly by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in several times during the Great Depression. And the debate, you know, differs because there are differing methods, and I don't think it's all because we have different politics. Unfortunately, I think the public tends to view us as much more polarized than we are. For example, most minimum wage scholars, whether they're opposed or come out opposed in their findings to minimum wages or in favor of them, find that employers like to increase minimum their employees to just above the new above the new minimum wage. So typically, studies of all stripes, from researchers of all stripes, find a big spike in the number of jobs that's just above the new minimum wage. That makes a lot of intuitive sense, whether you're an academic or not. The odd thing about the UW report is it finds no such spike. The jobs are missing. Instead, it finds job gains where they shouldn't find them because of the minimum wage at the very high-paying jobs. And this, to me, suggests that they've made some rookie mistakes, that there's some methods problems, and those include the comparison errors they used and the fact that they left out 48% of the low-wage workforce. And so anyone who is getting a wage increase, say in a fast food franchise, in their study, would disappear from their data. They show up as a wage, not as a wage increase, but as a job loss, even though those people would have been going, there are people who would have been going from a single-site business, this is getting into the weeds a little bit, to a fast food franchise to get the higher minimum wage that Seattle set for them.
All right, let me jump in, Mike. As you said, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here because I want to sort of stick with this line of questioning and give Salim Firth a chance to answer the same question. I mean, do you agree with Michael Reich's sort of idea about what the basic purpose of a minimum wage is?
I actually think we have a very confused national dialogue about what is the purpose of the minimum wage. So I don't agree that it's a living wage. I don't think that it's realistic to expect that everyone who has a job in the economy can support a family on that job, right? I started out as a teenager working for the town, making five something, and that was great. I got really valuable experience. I think it's reasonable to have a minimum wage that prevents abuse, right? You don't want an employer saying, hey, work for me, I'll eventually give you a really good job. I'm not going to pay you anything now, and stringing people along. I can see cases where you just have an abusive relationship and you want to prevent that in a really simple way.
But Salim, let me just jump in. The idea that the example that you put in place that, you know, you worked for a low wage when you were a young guy, and we all did that at one point. But, you know, Ben Castleman earlier in the hour made the point that increasingly around the country, we're not seeing sort of teenagers and college kids on break earning minimum wage. They're people who have been in the workforce for, you know, 5, 10, 20 years. And then when you start doing the calculation about what they're earning and how that doesn't really match with what it costs to live in the world, one starts to scratch one's head and say, can people really make ends meet with a minimum wage?
Sure. I think what I'm saying is if you care about getting people to the point where they can support a family, the minimum wage is the wrong way to do it.
I see.
One of the interesting things from the Seattle study was, even though the minimum wage that affected most people rose something like 30%, the actual take-home wage, hourly wage, for affected workers only rose between 3 and 4%. Some of them were above the original minimum. Some of them were in kind of exception categories. Tipped workers had a little bit more wiggle room. There's a variety of things going on there. But I think one of the really interesting things that we learned from this study as we get into this detailed hour and wage data is that minimum wages aren't that good at delivering. People don't just get that 30% increase right off the bat. So there are other policies. We have, you know, earned income tax credit where you have to be a certain age and you get credit for having children. That's a good anti-poverty program. Minimum wages are not very effective and they cut off the bottom rung of the ladder. We want to create, you know, or help people create employment history starting when they're 15, 16, 17 that get them a job that without any government intervention earns them $15 or $20 an hour once they have a family. Cutting off that bottom rung for the young people just creates a new generation of people who are going to be 25, have a kid, and no job experience.
All right. Let's get some callers into this conversation. Todd is calling from Springfield, Ohio. Todd, it's good to have you on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Well, small business owner, and I have been for a while, and in an industry which started out with a lot of these low-income jobs. And but the market values in my industry drove the wages up, not the government. And I'm going to go to one reason, which two or three callers ago, your gentleman said something about only driving stuff up 3%. But what he doesn't realize is when you're operating, even though I may be considered, you know, wealthy, which I consider myself wealthy, when your business is grossing $2 million, but you're only making 10%, that 3% is a lot of money. I would prefer we do away with it altogether because the federal government's not good at regulating what it should actually be and let the market values set the wage. And like your previous speaker said, it's not supposed to be the job, and that's the problem. It's
Todd, let me just jump in really quickly because we lost you at the very beginning. You're in the auto repair industry, is that right?
Correct.
All right, well, let me sort of put that to our panel. Michael Reich, there's Todd in Springfield talking about doing away with minimum wage altogether and let the market forces just handle it. Is that realistic?
Well, Salim already, you know, said that that would lead to incredible abuse by employers. And the point here is that the market, labor market, does not operate like other markets. It fails to produce a reasonable wage when it's not regulated. Every country in the world, except one or two, have minimum wage laws on the books for that reason. They don't all work as they should because they're not all enforced, but it's been an important and settled part of our policy for federally since 1938. And I think the issue is better phrased as, well, how high can we go? And I think that's a very that we are in an experimental period. I agree with Ben about that, but it's still, you know, has to be emphasized that there's no county in the United States where if you have a young kid that $15 plus the earned income tax credit and food stamps and so forth is enough to live on. I'm all for expanding the earned income tax credit. It's just not, I think, on the political agenda right now. And what is on the agenda, because of the advocates, is increasing the minimum wage. The two actually work very well together. But there are some problems with the earned income tax credit.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Ben Castleman, I want to get you back into this conversation. I mean, Salim made the point that, you know, relying too much on the minimum wage might be misguided. And, you know, we were just talking a moment ago about the earned income tax credit, the child credit, food stamps. I mean, is too much pressure being put on this one anti-poverty mechanism?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's safe to say that on some level, the politics of this have gotten a little bit ahead of the economics. I've been incredibly impressed by the success of the minimum wage movement. When a few years ago we started to hear about Fight for 15, you know, I confess to having rolled my eyes a little bit about any chance that we would ever see a wage at that level. And we've seen very quickly that happen in a lot of places. It's been really impressive from an organizing standpoint. The labor movement, which, you know, had sort of seemed all but dead in this country, has seen some progress out of that. So in terms of sort of putting this on the political agenda, it's been hugely successful. I think it's a fair question to ask whether the minimum wage should sort of play the prominent role that it does in sort of anti-poverty efforts. It's not to say that we should sort of go to abandon the minimum wage, I think as the last caller said, and get away from the minimum wage altogether. But there are other policies that play a role here. And I think that sort of at the baseline here, the question we have to be asking is what is actually benefiting low-wage workers? If the evidence starts to build, and we're not there yet, but if the evidence starts to build that a $12 or $15 minimum wage ends up hurting low-wage workers, then we have to account for that. We have to sort of be led by the evidence on this as it comes in.
Right. Let's do a couple more callers. Joe is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there. What's on your mind?
Essentially, what is the case is I live in a town that is, I mean, in Nashville, the vastly growing city population-wise, income-wise. I've had a job at $14 an hour as a warehouse manager. It's a skilled job. It's not something that you can just come in with no experience. And yet, the people that own the store make over $1.5 million a year. And I know that they could afford $15 an hour as a minimum wage, but I also know from dealing with them, I would lose my job if they did that because they wouldn't want to pay it. I guess my question would be, what's the kind of middle ground that has to happen? Because this is—I have a child right now; it's 2.5, and I have another one on the way, and we are barely making ends meet, and my wife works as well.
All right, Joe, it's a great question that you've put on the table, and I think it's a challenge that a lot of folks are facing out there. We're going to pick that up. I want to get one more call in here. Hamida is calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Hamida, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I represent upper middle-class suburbia from a town in Massachusetts, and I do know a lot of small business owners. We always hesitate to have this conversation about why is it such a bad thing if small business owners make a little less money? And it's always this conversation about raise the minimum wage or give the workers a little bit more. Well, we're going to pass the cost on to the consumer, or we're going to lay off people. We won't hire as many people. But again, small business owners are constantly, running around, giving the runaround to the law and hiring people for less than 32 hours so they don't have to give them health benefits or any of those other benefits that come with full-time employment. So minimum wage workers get the shaft there. And here we are again. Is it taboo to have a conversation in capitalist America? Cut into the bottom line of the small business owners. If you are making $200,000, as the auto repair mechanic said, that's 10% of his overhead or whatever his bringing in income is, what's the harm if he loses 2% or 3% of that and people who are making, say, $17,000, $18,000, $19,000 a year make, say, $20,000 a year?
Hamida, we got it. And it's a good question, and it's very much related to what we heard a moment ago from Joe from Nashville. So I'd like to get Michael and Salim to sort of respond to that. Michael Reich, I'll start with you. So the argument there, the conversation is too often about raising the minimum wage rather than asking businesses, small or large, to give up a couple of percent of their profits.
Well, I think the key thing is that these policies all phase in gradually. The caller was talking about where's the middle ground, and I think that is where the middle ground is. If you're talking about huge increases several years in a row, yeah, that's hard for small businesses or any businesses. But these are all phased in. They're not really increasing in any one year more than minimum wages have at many times in the past, especially at the city level. I think we should let the experiments continue, not just in Seattle, but in all the other cities and states that are gradually going up to $15. my Berkeley team is monitoring these experiments in as real time as possible. And so far, in a number of cities that are lower cost, well, we're not finding any negative effects. The economists will continue to debate it, but it's way too soon to make any specific recommendations that we should do away with these increases.
Got it. I want to go over to Salim before our time runs out. Salim, respond to those last two callers talking about, you know, where is the pressure on the businesses to give up something to make it a little more manageable for low-wage workers? Is that a fair question?
Sure, but you know, if it's really easy to start a business and start earning, you know, $200,000 or $1 million a year, I think we should probably all get off the air and start businesses, right? I mean, if money is sitting around on the ground like that, it shouldn't be that hard to jump in and make that kind of cash. It's obviously great if people want to have, you know, kind of social businesses, start something that's really not about you but about your workers, and you'll get good people, right? If you're paying above what the rest of the market is paying, not just if the government raises the minimum wage, but if you go ahead and raise your own minimum wage above what's around you, you'll get better people, you get loyalty and hard work. That's tremendous. I certainly applaud businesses that do that. We can choose to patronize businesses that have, you know, a loyalty model. And I don't think it's reasonable, though, to sit in City Hall or the State House and say, hey, we're going to run your business for you. We think we can do this better than you. I don't think that's a reasonable relationship between government and business.
Got it. Salim Firth at the Heritage Foundation, thanks so much for joining us as well. Michael Reich from UC Berkeley, thank you. And Ben Castleman, thanks so much for being our guide. He's from 538. You can link to his piece on the minimum wage. Thank you all, my guests. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.